Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Hump with Katie. I'm your host, Katie Thoreau, and I cannot tell you how excited I am for today's episode. This is with the amazing bassist and incredible educator, Paul Ellison. If you're new to The Hump, this is a series where I'm interviewing some of the world's greatest and most talented artists to find out why are they so amazing, how did it happen, really what was their story, and ultimately, what can we learn from them? We've already had some fantastic interviews, like Carlos Enriquez, Larry Grenadier, Rufus Reed, Ken Piplowski, and so many others. You can listen to all of these episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and you can actually go watch them on YouTube. So go like, subscribe, download, and hey, tell me who you want to hear from next. Before I bring you today's episode, I'd love to thank our sponsors. And first up, we have Kohlsteins. You guys, I absolutely love Kohlsteins String Shop. They have two great locations in Long Island, New York, and an amazing online string website where you can get just about anything. If you use the promo code KATIE10, you'll get 10% off your entire online purchase at Kohlstein.com. And up next, we have the clothing company Jams World. You all know by now how much I love Jams World. Of course, I'm wearing a Jams World right now. And the reason why I love the clothing so much is because it keeps me cool and comfortable. It's made from 100% spun crushed rayon, which is why it keeps me so cool, especially when I'm playing bass and singing on stage. The artwork is so unique and it's screen printed right onto the fabric. I feel like it's made just for me. If you use the promo code JAZZ15 at JamsWorld.com, you'll get 15% off your next purchase. I was so inspired after speaking to our guest today, Paul Ellison. He not only is just a fantastic, unbelievable, amazingly talented bassist and historical knowledge of everything bass and music in general, he's such an open book, but he's a pedagogical genius. I was saying it'd be interesting to draw out a map of all the bass players that have been touched by his teaching, and it's just incredible, and I felt really lucky to be able to spend this time with him, and he's just that type of a person. He feels just as lucky to share his time and teach other students. So I'm really happy to share this with you. If you have some high blood pressure, it's definitely going to bring that down and make you feel good. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Paul Ellison. Yes, perfect. There we go. Let's
close that particular page.
There we go.
Oh,
fabulous.
Now I can relax.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah.
I put this out because I found it yesterday and I thought it's about the cutest thing I've ever seen. Not certainly not because I'm in it, but that's Rabat on the beach in Quebec.
Oh, that is great. I like that. He's heavily sun covered too.
he's such an albino that if he if he's not careful, he just roasts.
Yeah.
In no time at all.
Yeah. Well, fabulous, Paul. We'll have you listening to Rufus in no time. Don't worry. We'll get you there on time.
Well, you know, Gary and Rufus and I all drifted through Chicago and Northwestern mm-hmm. at the same time period.
Mm.
Exactly. Gary and I are the same age. Rufus is a little younger, thankfully, for Rufus. But we were all drifting in and out of our relationship with Warren Benfield, who was... Mm-hmm. such a icon of bass teachers and bass players and an amazing experience and amazing human being.
Wow.
And that's actually how I got to know Gary a couple ways. My teacher in Chicago was Harold Siegel, whose brother still played in the studios in Los Angeles for a very long time. And his son was the pianist on Gary's first album.
Hmm.
So there's so many connections there that it's just ridiculous. And then, of course, Rufus and I have crossed paths many times. He's been here to do classes for me, and we've done things together all over the place. And he and Doris are just such amazingly special people. And how many notes does it take before you know it's Rufus?
Almost zero, right?
Yeah. I mean, just the touch in the beginning, and you get that silk feeling that just kind of covers you.
Yeah.
And okay, it's Rufus. It's like the Ray Brown sound and mm-hmm. that place on the top of the bass that John has that's worn off because of the way he would smack his E string and get that sound that nobody else. It's like Willie Nelson's guitar.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a hole in it.
Yeah.
Ray Brown never got to, but I love that.
Yeah, and I remember, I actually, when I was maybe 12, you did a master class at Colburn, and I remember going there and remembers like specifically things that you said. And same with Rufus, he said something, I think I saw him when I was 14 or 15 at a IAJE conference, and it so many things went over my head, but I remember him saying, so many bass players play the bass in an L shape, you know, across in half position, and then just up the G string. But right. That really made sense to me, even at that point. It's like, okay, I need to learn everything here, right?
That's great that you were in that class. Malachi was in that class. Do you run into each other in LA? Malachi is...
Yeah. No, I haven't. That's a person I would really love to catch up with.
Because Ruth Underwood is such a historic person in our on our planet.
Yeah.
And so many connections between Zappa and Malachi plays, I think the number of instruments he's up to, it's somewhere between 22 and 27.
Oh, I would have guessed like 100 at this point.
Well, it depends upon what level of expertise.
Yeah.
And when Malachi was in school, we used to try to figure out how many books got read in a week. And she couldn't have a lot. Well, she did have two lockers, but there wasn't enough room in the lockers for the books that she covered in a week.
Yeah. So brilliant. I remember actually we would play, we would get together and play like on the weekends, play duets. And I remember one time we were going to play Telemann canons, and I forgot my book. And they were like, oh, it's okay. I have a photographic memory. And I'm like, well, that's good for you. That works out for you, not for me, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, but it's not in your face. It was just like, that's natural.
Oh, it was just a thing. And it came with migraines, and it came with other things too. And it's what John and I talk about all the time, about how many occupations we have as bass teachers.
Therapist. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And living through the whole process of that was quite spectacular.
Oh yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about that because you are, it's hard to find people who haven't been touched by what you do, you know, today, of all ages. So I really want to get to you as an educator and how that all happened. But can we start kind of at the beginning of how you even came to play bass?
Sure. Lucky enough to grow up in the middle of Manhattan on 72nd Street, where Riverside Park starts. Mm-hmm. And my dad was in the entertainment business. He was an advertising and personnel person for Decca Records. So we had Louis Armstrong in the house and all kinds of people from the Cuban music, which was very big at the time, mm-hmm. including Desi Arnaz and people like that, and Spanish flamenco players. So all this stuff was going on in the house.
Yeah.
But the biggest reason was my grandparents and my amazing grandmother, who was a farm girl in Pennsylvania. And she had been studying piano with somebody in this little town. And at 18, she realized the farm was not for her. So she packed up her stuff and took trains and buses and got herself to Carl Fisher in Chicago and went in and asked for a job. And they said, well, what do you do? And she says, I play the piano.
Yeah.
Well, play me something. So what do you want? And they put a piece of music that she'd never seen. And she not only played it, she improvised on it.
Mm.
And they said, well, we have a place for you. So she started every day at 11 work days, 5 days a week. And she would go from 11 to 2 in the lobby of Carl Fisher, playing all of the new music that people could come in and buy.
Wow.
Because in the early part of the 20th century, that's how you got your music.
Around what year was this?
Probably in the teens and 20s, right around then. And that's how she started doing all of that. And she also had been always studying organ. Mm. And eventually she worked at, there's lots more, but I'll get to the important stuff. So she got to New York and started looking at theater organ silent movie jobs. And this is the Italian part. His name was Joe Zavelli. My grandfather had the theater or had one of those silent movie theater orchestras, and he needed a new organist. So he had auditions and he hired my grandmother. And his colleagues were beside themselves. Joe, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, he said, what do you mean? What am I doing? Stella's the best. I hired the best person I can hire. So that's having that kind of grandparent, yeah. Both of them. And just there was no beating that. I remember going to talent shows when I was a little kid with my grandmother, and somebody's pianist would have lost the music or anything like that. She just got up there and said, what are you singing, honey?
Wow.
And just, okay, sing the beginning so I know where, okay. And so she had the key and she had, and to cut from there to her final days at 94, I was sitting with her in Florida in her apartment, my grandparents' apartment, because my grandfather was still there too. And I said, well, I know that you played a lot of rags and Joplin and stuff like that for the silent movies. She looked at me and smiled and got up. Her arthritis was pretty far along at 94.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't matter. She went over, turned the organ on. Black and White just came screaming out of the organ.
Mm.
And she made a few mistakes and just kind of shake her head, but she kept going.
Yeah.
And got through the whole thing. And then it was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I've had the opportunity to be with people during their final days, and how music really is just so deep buried in the brain and in the body. And I've been around people who become paraplegic and, you know, can't verbally have a conversation, but you start singing and not only does the melody come back, but the words, and it's so fascinating and so beautiful.
Right. And it's among the things that I've noticed, my mother was the same kind of powerhouse. She had sung in the Riverside Church in New York when I was younger and had done a fair amount of professional singing, but she also did business school.
Mm.
And I don't know if you remember the big department stores, Marshall Field and Company, that started in Chicago and then was in a few other cities, kind of a Neiman Marcus type store. She was the New York, she ran the New York office. And she was the first woman to do that. So I just love having that kind of background. Not that I ever noticed.
Yeah.
But the thing was to never notice.
Yeah, it was normal.
That you the people that you learned from and got your power from and that had the rudder of your life were these two dynamo people that have been my mother and my grandmother.
Yeah.
So the combination of my grandmother and grandfather, when I resisted playing the piano and I resisted playing, he played the violin. I didn't want to play that either. And I'd listen to them play because we had a pedal organ in our house, even in Chicago when they came to visit, when we eventually moved to Chicago. And I just resisted playing until I got to high school.
Hmm.
And then in high school, I went to see the band director first and said, I've always wanted to be a percussionist and a drummer. And he said, are you kidding me? You know what I have in my band.
Yeah.
Way too many drummers and percussionists. Go see this guy downstairs from here. That's the orchestra room. And tell him that you'd like to start playing something. So I did that at 14, and here was a guy that looked like Peter Lorre, exactly like Peter Lorre. And he looked at me and he said, oh, big one.
Hmm.
You see that thing over there in the corner? I said, you mean the bass, the double bass? And, oh, you know what it is. Yes. He said, well, I could see to it that you'll get lessons on that, private lessons, and you can start playing it this afternoon in orchestra class.
Hmm.
In string class. That was it.
Yeah.
And even that first week, after the first week of school, there was no bag for that bass, but it wasn't raining.
Yeah.
So I walked it home.
Yeah.
And I stopped on the corner of Broadway, and which was on my way to the house. It isn't quite like Broadway in New York, Broadway in Chicago.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's a big, it's at least four lanes. And had to wait for the light. And when finally the light changed, the last car to pull up on my left opened the window and threw out a couple quarters.
Oh.
And I just smiled, picked up the quarters and waved at them and then went on. And my mother said that was the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
It was your first paid gig.
Yeah.
And you didn't even have to play for it.
Nice. Well, that's such a great beginning story. So did you get lessons right away?
I did. I got a scholarship with one of the Chicago Symphony guys.
Mm-hmm.
And this, as I was doing the string class stuff, he started me on Schimandl. So, okay. And he was a kind of German Czech background and smoked the most horrible cigars that I've ever been around in my life.
During your lessons?
Yep. And the room in the Fine Arts Building in downtown Chicago would fill with smoke. My eyes would be watering. And it got so bad that he opened the door and walked down the hallway to let the room air out.
Yeah.
And he'd holler back, C sharp. And so that didn't last too long, even though it was a scholarship. And that's shortly after that that I found Jeffrey Siegel's father, Harold Siegel. And he'd been playing in the studios in Chicago. He had played in the symphony, but he let, in those days, the studio jobs were like the cherry of all jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to look at YouTube and see what he looked like, there was a thing called Shock Theater that was broadcast from Chicago on Saturday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like one of his kind of, it's hard to call it a jazz gig, but a lot of the things that they played were very nice, mm-hmm. very tasty. And so it was super for me to have a teacher that understood that world and that had come from the symphony as well.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was all one thing.
Yeah.
And I started playing gigs with an accordion and a C melody sax and a way too big drum set. And we would play for anything, you know, charity balls and Sisters of Charity,
yeah,
just whatever. And if you made $5 or $10 and got a meal out of it, you know, that's what you did.
Yeah, and all the while you're learning stuff, even if it's not like it's, you know, subconscious. It's just sinking in.
And you're building trust in yourself, and you. Mm-hmm. And it's like what John talks about being able to hear what you're playing.
Yeah.
Which I heard you sing, and I saw you do exactly John's thing on your wonderful low notes for peace, et cetera. So I was doing that without knowing that was anything. It just, what else are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
Here's this tune. You got to learn this tune, and oh yeah, that I hear what the accordion is doing, and. Then I learned too to how to stand by the pianist, and I didn't plan, but it's right here, and I happened to be in the studio. So there's the first trio.
There you go.
And I'm standing right back in the right place by the keyboard, so mm-hmm. that I could watch his hands and see the chords that he was playing, and stay out of trouble.
Yeah.
That drummer, Terry Applebaum, went on to become the youngest percussionist to ever play with the Chicago Symphony.
Wow.
And ended up as one of the deans at Northwestern and retired as a dean of Kansas City Conservatory. Just a super drummer. In any sense. I mean, put him behind the set or give him a marimba and just dynamite. And his brother, the pianist, was a scientist and a composer. So he was forever writing things for us. And that was inspirational.
Wow.
And then he'd want me to play the bow on some of them because he had those ideas. And we were all listening to Richard Davis, who at that period in the 50s in New York, Piano Perspectives is the album that comes up to my mind. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to find because it was never digitized, so they never made a CD out of it. But there's a really nice version of it on YouTube that's quite clean.
Mm, okay.
You can hear it all. And Richard was a Juilliard graduate.
Yeah.
And there wasn't anything he couldn't do. And when he would play a bowed solo and go up into thumb position, it was just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
So it was one more thing to hear at that age that was a crossover. Because I would like to sound as good in the orchestra as when I got a little solo or something. So
yeah.
It was nice to have that.
Yeah, what an amazing time and influences. And it's kind of funny today because there's YouTube, right? And there's you can look at everything and hear everything, but it's one thing to do that, but then also to just live it and kind of be present and realize everything that's going on. That's really fantastic.
Well, Chicago was really good about taking care of kids. Like the first time I heard Paul Chambers was at the London House, and they would have open rehearsals on Saturday afternoon with no alcohol.
Yeah.
And we would pay, I don't even remember, $3, $5, something like that. And you got a Coca-Cola and you got to listen to them play.
Wow.
So, like, really?
Yeah.
And it was like, where do you get that kind of gift?
Yeah, that's true.
And there was no communication. So how did you find out about it? Well, that's why when you have a teacher that's in the studios who is understanding about that kind of thing in addition to everything else that was going on. But I don't know if you know Paul Chambers' Tale of the Fingers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's my ringtone. That's been my ringtone since iPhones, since we were able to put our own ringtone in an iPhone. And that whole album is just unbelievable. And I got to see him, and I got to see Sam Jones, and just everybody.
So you were just soaking it up at that point. You said, it wasn't like, okay, I just do this kind of performance, this jazz or other things, or I just do that. It was everything.
There wasn't any separation. Because, I look at my dear sweet grandmother get up and just improvise her head off, or go to a church and hear her play Bach, or play something with my grandfather, something legit, or one of his compositions, which when he was in the theaters, he would do. Belwin was his publisher, so he would do quite a few things for them, because people would ask for the music that they heard in the theater, and the theater was called the Parthenon. Mm-hmm. And it was in Brooklyn, and it was a very popular non-Manhattan where people didn't have to get into the city in order to see. So he had a lot of followers, and so that's why Belwin got him to give them some of his material. Mm. So with all that going on at the same time, and listening to his story, he grew up in the worst possible ghetto at the time, in the Italian ghetto in the east side of New York. And in order to avoid the mafia, the Black Hand, and all of that at his father's grocery store, he lied about his age. He's almost 15, still 14, and he got into the Navy. And the Navy wanted to finish his musical education at the Navy School of Music, which goes along with the Institute in outside of Baltimore. It's not Ann Arbor. It's where the Naval Academy is. Mm-hmm. So they educated him. He learned all about composition and arranging. He learned a few more instruments. Of course, he had to learn to play something besides the violin. So he learned to play the drums and clarinet. But he learned to do everything. Just like, I think about, when you think about Bach, and that when he was writing his cantatas and doing something for church every week.
Yeah.
The town musicians were paid by the town, and they had to go and play with him in church on Sunday. So some of those flute parts and other parts that we take for granted are classical players. They're the local flute player.
I know. I've thought about that too, especially Bach, like the amount of work he's written and how many things just
happens to be on my desk. So I'll just just hold it up for anybody that might want it or doesn't Bach. Have it.
Music in the Castle of Heaven. Yeah.
Yeah. The Elliot Gardner Bach book. And he tells all of those stories. But
yeah,
so, but, the,
yeah, you're right.
Just music.
Yeah. At that time, it's like, I mean, I'm thinking in Bach's time, it's like someone who cobbled shoes also could play like violin, you know, or piano. It was just pretty commonplace.
Right. The one that's in the gray bag over here is 1690.
Wow.
And I keep it in gut, and I do a lot of early stuff. There are a couple things on the Houston Bach Society. I'm just thinking of recent things to reference. Houston Bach Society, it's if you look at the timing, it would be just early December. It's the Advent. Mm-hmm. Advent Vespers.
Yeah.
And that's all on there. And Cantata 61, which is the Advent cantata, is on there. And even though I'm mostly an underhand player, although I studied overhand with Rabat as my midlife crisis, I'm playing on a Baroque bow that you can hold like a gamba bow, mm-hmm. you can hold like a German bow, or you can hold it in three different places as an overhand bow. And in most pieces, I switch back and forth to get the right sound and the right kind of response. Mm. So it's like everything else. What do you need to do to get the job done?
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. So we go from you being heavily influenced in Chicago by what everything you're hearing, your family as an influence, but it's just normal. It's normal to you. And then you ended up going to school, going to college, right?
Mm-hmm.
And was that, did you want to do that? Or were you already like, okay, I'm gigging, I don't need to go to school? Or were you excited to do that?
It was a really interesting time, the early 60s.
Yeah.
Like 1960, 59, 60. And having grown up, I didn't know it was an advantage or anything good that I'd grown up in Manhattan and Chicago. Mm-hmm. But what I also knew was I was ready to not be in Manhattan and Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we had a visitor at our high school, and he was from New Mexico. And he talked to me after class, and he said, "We will support you. We will pay for your schooling. We will give you money to live and to buy books. And here's the reason that you should come and see us. There are three orchestras in our area, and our string players play a concert a month in each of those orchestras, and you will be paid to do that. And we will give you the transportation in order to get to those three. Because when you're in Portales, New Mexico, and then you have to go to Amarillo or you have to go to Roswell," and this is before there were space aliens in Roswell, "and when you have to go to those places, you don't just drive your 57 Chevy. You have to have a good school vehicle to take mm-hmm. all the gear and all that stuff." And I just thought, that's crazy. Because I would have gone to Northwestern or yeah. Juilliard or Manhattan or something like that. Because they were all things that I'd grown up with and knew and mm-hmm. understood. But it was really interesting to me. And I've always been terminally independent. And which, again, I credit both my grandparents and my mom. And that just struck me as the most interesting thing I'd ever heard of. Mm-hmm. And my mother was extremely skeptical, particularly when we moved to Chicago, which she was the first woman with an executive position in this department store because she had topped out in New York and they wanted to continue to let her grow. But she thought Chicago compared to Manhattan was a hick town. And I heard that from her all the time. And when I told her what I wanted to do, she just she said, "Do you mind if I drive down with you and when you go?" And of course, there weren't things like we have today. I had no idea what it looked like or what I was getting into. But of course, so we drove down together, and as we were driving into the town before we got to the university is quite spectacular, but in the outskirts of town were these residences, and my mother looked and said, adobe haciendas, very quaint.
Yeah.
And in a kind of New York way, slightly sarcastic and sardonic. And by the time we got to the university, it was clear that that was a nice facility, and we met some people. Then I had to take her back to the 20th Century Limited, which went between Los Angeles and Chicago from Clovis, New Mexico. And if you know Route 66, mm-hmm. you hear the lyric.
Yeah.
Clovis, New Mexico. So yeah. That's where we were. So I took her to the train. As she was getting on the train, which only stops, I mean, they don't turn it off, it just stops. And she looks at me and she said, you know, you can come home whenever you want.
Oh.
And thanks, Mom. But anyway, from there, I met Don Robertson, mm-hmm. who we all know and love.
Yeah.
And we started cooking up stuff together back in those days. And it was accepted that I would play in the lab band.
Hmm.
It was accepted that I would play in the chamber orchestra and the big orchestra. And they had all of that stuff down there, which yeah. was amazing to me. And I couldn't have been happier. Because we could go out into the countryside, of which there is plenty.
Yeah.
And raise hell. And it turned out to be an archaeological site. There's wow. a thing called the Clovis Man, which is like 30,000 years.
Wow.
And it's where we used to drink beer and light a bonfire.
Yeah.
And then actually Don Robertson would find spear points and other things. And eventually they started finding mammoth bones and mammoth tusks and things like that. So while we were in school, that became a thing.
Wow.
And we were still allowed, we weren't disallowed from going there,
mm-hmm.
but we had to clean up our act a little bit.
Yeah. 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 Be respectful.
And Don and I have been friends, and just the third amigo is John, because the three of us go fishing. A lot.
Okay. Yeah.
But the John relationship came after that, that we can credit ISB with that. Other than the fact that it was something that was just going to happen eventually, and it was only a matter of how it was going to happen.
Exactly. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time, so I'm going to skip some things, but I do want to know.
Sure.
So you finished in New Mexico, and did you go right to, you went to Northwestern as well?
Right. I went back to grad school to Chicago because I knew that I needed to do that.
And why?
You know, it was to have just been a musician from New Mexico was not sufficient. And I knew that. And I had a sense of that. And I did always want to, I knew all the Chicago guys, because when I played in the Chicago Youth Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony played in the same space, or if we were playing in orchestra hall, they had an afternoon concert on Saturdays. So they knew when we got out, and they timed it so they could have lunch with the bass section of the Chicago Youth Orchestra.
Yeah.
Which was amazing, because I got to know all of those characters.
Yeah.
And there were a number of them that were really characters. But I had always known about the teaching of Warren Benfield and wanted to work with him. So that was something that I'd had in my mind even when somehow I found my way in Tanglewood when I was still in New Mexico.
Oh.
Because my teacher was very smart in New Mexico, and he took me up to where the Boston Symphony was playing a concert in Albuquerque and had me audition for the Tanglewood committee while they were on the road.
Nice.
So that was unusual for Tanglewood, but it was wonderful for me.
And I bet, like, you know, at this time, that seemed like a great teacher, that you're also subliminally learning these lessons of helping your students.
I started thinking about how other people play and what they could do to be better when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see these people struggling and not really thinking about physically what they were doing. They were just trying to find notes and had no idea what it could look like. And I realized that I had to be very careful with how I said things and offering as a colleague, offering, not telling them how or what to do, but asking them, had they thought about this or that?
Yeah.
So I started thinking about all of that even in high school, and I was rebuffed a few times, but also a few things went well. Mm-hmm. And I actually started doing it then, and then did it all through school, all through college, undergrad and grad, and any place that we would go, like Amarillo or Roswell or Lubbock, there would be people that I could work with and figure out how to do that. And most of the time it was just me wanting to do it.
Yeah.
Didn't have anything to do with money.
Yeah.
So it was an interest that I didn't then understand, but it's a pedagogical, David Moore and I, do more of this than you can possibly imagine. And I'm sure you're aware of his Fractal Fridays.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And when he was a student, and he knows that he has the distinction of being the most annoying student that I've ever had.
Those are good.
Yeah. And John is the person that saved him, because to get him into USC, he wasn't ready for the classical department. So yeah. John accepted him. And anyway, he would be waiting for me outside my studio at USC with his legal pad and a pen or pencil. And his first thing he would say is, "I only have a few questions." And to this day, we still do those pedagogical things.
Yeah.
He might have caught some of that from me. I hope so. But I don't have any explanation for it other than it's always been there.
Mm. Well, now you mentioned David Moore and being at USC. You were at USC and you were the head of the string department, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we'll kind of like fast forward a little bit, but that sure. did that come before or after Houston?
We started Rice from the ground up in 1975. And I was actually there in 74 teaching some non-majors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been playing principal in the symphony for a while.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard of anything like what they wanted to do at Rice. They had been given a grant, a huge grant, to start a professional music school that was aligned with a full-time academic institution like Rice. And I thought that was a great idea, and I talked to them about it. And then I got hired to play the then acting dean that would become the dean, hired me for a Bach B minor mass, which I was happy to do. And it was in the chapel back up above from behind with the organ. And really the way it should be done, which is rarely done that way, but it was spectacular. What I didn't know was that was my audition.
Oh.
And when it was done, he said, "Well, all those things we've talked about, we're going to do it, and we want you to do that." So I started doing that, and they had such a great attitude. They said, "We're not playing a numbers game. You bring the people that you want. And if it's two in the first year, that's fine. We're going to start small, because there aren't people just hanging around waiting to be picked up that are as serious as the people that we want."
Mm-hmm.
So we grew it in that way. It was very healthy.
Yeah.
And then in the 80s, one of our former deans that went to USC asked me if I wanted to come out and have a look at what was going on. So fast forward to 86. And I thought, sure, why not?
Yeah.
But I was still playing principal in the symphony.
Yeah.
So, but I'd been to Paris. I'd had my midlife crisis at age 40 and seen Rabat play with Cincinnati, play Frank Proto's concerto for him with orchestra. And I was sitting there with John and with Edgar Meyer, with Hal Robinson, with David Walter, with like Rufus, about 300 of all the bass. You would know every single name that I gave you, you would know.
Yeah.
And we were all stymied by what he was doing with the orchestra and how he was doing it. And I called him. That was in November. And I called him just around the 1st of December and said, I've got to come to Paris. I've got to work with you. And he said, no. And I said, well, I really want to do this. I'm not coming just to learn your tricks.
Yeah.
I want to learn from the beginning because you studied by yourself. And now I want to study with yourself. No, he said. And I said, okay, well, I've been thinking about selling my bass and becoming a conductor.
Was that true?
And he said, you are kidding me. No. And I was half kidding.
Yeah.
And he said, you must come. So New Year's Day, same year, a new year, obviously, 82 from 81. And I was in Paris. And I had taken leaves from the symphony and from Rice and all of that.
Wow, that's a huge leap.
Everybody but David Walter thought I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But David said, go do it.
Yeah.
Learn to speak French. Do all of the things there. Just go there and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Get as much time as you can. So that was that. So having done that, a little trip to Los Angeles and taking a leave from one thing or another seemed like nothing at all.
It was nothing, yeah.
And so I did both things at the same time. I was doing Rice and USC and commuting.
Wow.
And both were pretty much full time.
Wow. Did you ever feel like you burned the candle at both ends?
About 8 years in, yeah. The dean at Rice called me in and he said, I'll leave out the expletive. WTF, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I want to hear what you're doing.
Yeah.
And he was an amazing human, Rhodes Scholar, classic Oxford education. He could be you while you were talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to recreate what my experience was. And he disappeared, and I found myself to be having to tell myself what it was I was up to. And by the time we were through with the conversation, I got what I needed to do and how I needed to do it and what was healthy for me.
How lucky to have someone like that.
I thank him regularly for that.
And they didn't have to say anything.
No.
Yeah.
Never. He left it all in my court, which is something that I love to do with students.
Yeah.
And
from my experience, I can attest to maybe that rubbed off on John Clayton.
We all, it's a common thing these days. And that's where it has to come from anyway.
Mm-hmm, of course.
And it's just like this week's, I don't know if you've read this week's Fractal Friday yet, but that's the last part of the center part of what David is talking about this week. It's in three parts and it's especially that.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains the systems best used to get you where you need to get prior to thinking about performance so that your performance, you will trust what you've done.
Yeah.
So it all has to come from us. And if somebody can help you not reinvent the wheel, then that's great.
Yeah. So what are some of your favorite things? I mean, you've been teaching for a very long time. And I mean, I know the answer, but how does it feel when you see your students succeed in any way? You know, even if they don't continue bass, but they go to law school and that's what they figured out they wanted to do. So, but how does that make you feel when you see your students not only succeeding, but happy?
Makes me cry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If I think too much about it. Nina is such a workhorse. I mean, I see, is it a video a day? I mean,
At least.
And what she went through to get where she is.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had to do to heal her when she was in school because she had a really nasty injury.
Mm.
She had that in common with Tracy Rowell. Tracy is the teacher at Oberlin. She also had a debilitating injury that we had to work through. And the result of the two of them and where they are and what they're doing, it's hard for me to talk about it.
Yeah. And that's just the sign of a great teacher, a great person. When, I mean, we know people, we've met people where it's on the other end, they're like, oh, well, good for them, but that means I don't get to do that. Or, you know, oh, someone else should be doing that. So I can tell there's none of that. And so what are some of your favorite things about teaching any type of student? Because you teach very tiny students. You teach, you know, from the very beginning to, you know, extremely advanced students, and, you know, getting them from advanced to higher levels. So what are some of your favorite things about teaching?
The process of assessing where a person is and where they think they are and what they see as what might be, is there a way for this to be easier for me? And to see what is the priority with this person? What's the single thing that's going to elevate what they're doing next, like what's next in line for them. Mm-hmm. When they have the desire and they really want it, sometimes that gets in the way of what they could do physically that might be a little bit more efficient. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of, is it more important to get the right shape of one hand or the other in order to satisfy what people think is pedagogically correct? Mm-hmm. Or is there a way to produce a body gesture, a move? I do sports analogy all the time. Mm-hmm. And Tai Chi and yoga and Alexander and all the other things there are to do, Feldenkrais, because we are musical athletes. We will always be musical athletes. And understanding that the combination of the physics of the instrument and the choreography of instrumental playing, that has to be of prime concern. And very often, I don't know if you noticed my ISB class from last summer, it was beyond pounding. Mm. Pounding is the worst of the worst, and there's a time and place for that, for sure. But that aspect of self-discovery and understanding, it was best summed up just before December in one of the big PGA tournaments, and this gentleman was not hitting his putts because he was a little too tense. Mm-hmm. And he remembered that he could close his eyes. And if he set himself up perfectly physically and went through his routine, that the result would always be there.
Yeah.
And his last five putts were with his eyes closed. Mm-hmm. And he won the tournament. And we don't always trust that. We've got all the dots on our fingerboard, and we've got all of these other little things, which are fine. And it's like Edgar says, that's the last 3%. You can't rely on that and shouldn't rely on it. So the physical aspect of what we do and how we use our bodies, that's probably the most fascinating thing to me about the whole process.
And also because everybody's different size and shape, and every base is different. There's not, and except for now, you know, there's new companies, but there's not like a single size for a 3/4 base.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
I love the sports analogies too, because I love baseball. And after spring training, it's like, whoa, somebody worked on their swing over the break, or this last World Series with the Dodgers and Tampa Bay, the Tampa Bay's first baseman had this incredible leap. He had this incredible, it was like 3 feet in the air, and he looked like a ballet dancer, but that's how he figured it out, how to play first base. So someone like Nina, because we spoke too, comes to mind. It's like, you don't have to play, you know, like the picture says, and you've got to find what works for you.
I learned more from teaching Nina than I could tell you in the next hour.
Wow.
And just seeing what she needed to do and how we were going to work to set her up to be able to do what she had to do. Mm-hmm. And my favorite comparison, and they almost overlap, Rex Serrani is the principal of the Met. He's 6'7". Mm-hmm. And then there's Nina. And his issues were exactly the opposite. His hands were too big. Mm-hmm. His base was too small. And it was just as awkward for him.
Yeah.
In another way.
Yeah. I know someone was asking me about John Clayton, and they were like, oh, it must be so easy for him to play because he's bigger. And I'm like, well, have you seen his fingers? You know, he really has to maneuver how to play bass differently for himself. And actually, I use him as a great example. I have a couple students that are well over 6 feet, and I'm like, watch this video of John Clayton because he has to do, he does this with his wrist. You know, that might work for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one more reason to watch Stephen Colbert, because we get to see Jean-Baptiste. And when you notice his fingers when he's playing, it's John. It just happens to be a piano.
Yeah.
He's got all of the extra in his fingers, and he's got those little curves.
Yeah.
The little angles that John has in his fingers. I know.
John's hands just remind me of like an old ancient oak tree with all these branches.
Yeah.
Okay. I just got maybe one more question for you. This has just been so thrilling for me, Paul. And I feel like you're never done learning about the bass, about music. You seem like that's what consumes you in a good way.
That's what I'm going to do today.
Yeah.
And I've been teaching one of the things we did when we started in 75 with the Shepherd School is that we would have a regular orchestral bass class. And that wasn't happening. It was happening in one level at Curtis, but it wasn't the way we set it up. And it's always set up so that the previous week, you go over what the material is, mm-hmm. and you look at all of the skill sets and where the music is coming from and what the whole thing's about. Then everybody gets at least 1 week and sometimes two before each one has to play it individually. Mm-hmm. And how do you get from that through the process? So that's a long time to do that class.
Yeah.
But what I find is that I've never done the same thing with any one of our pieces in our standard repertoire it's a 2-year cycle as I did 2 years ago.
And
I'm going back over Mendelssohn 4 because I've got some new ideas. And I always think about what are the weakest people in the classes struggling with the most? And how can we find a way to keep that beautiful hand position and add to a graceful Tai Chi type choreography that will allow them to get from place to place without any of the weird, awkward things that show up.
Yeah.
And I get energized by that, and just, it's kind of a pain because I have to go back and redo my own markings and set it up with new photocopies and for things for people to put in their tablets, et cetera, whatever their system is. So it's way more work for me, but I can't imagine doing it any other way.
Yeah, I get that. What lucky students you have that you're constantly reworking and exploring. So last question is, do you have any advice for students? I guess at any stage, but you know, those who are serious, maybe studying in school and maybe they're preparing for orchestra auditions and summer programs and things like that, or anything you want to impart on, you know, people who are, you know, serious about playing the bass.
Well, the first thing I want to do is say that I'm the lucky one because I get to have those students that are serious and that are willing to engage about that seriousness and aren't afraid to be David Moore geeky, that aren't afraid to be Rex Serrani and go to Berlin to find a bass the size that he needed. And by the way, at 6'7", he plays a 9/8 five string.
I'd never even knew that existed.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it was out there for him.
Yeah. Exactly. Something is there, one place or another.
Yeah.
The 5/8 bass, Nina's solo bass was made for her. The string length is a little bit different than Christian Lauber usually makes, but it's perfect for her.
Yeah.
And her hatches is the same. So when you when you're working with master makers like that, you can get what you need.
Mm-hmm.
I think in today's world, there everything is available to them. It's available with David's wonderful work, with the various things that are on YouTube. They need to be thoughtful and careful and do exactly what you're listening to your podcast, having the kinds of questions that you have.
Mm-hmm.
That's their most, their biggest strong suit.
Mm-hmm.
Is don't be afraid to ask. My email is out there on the net, on the Rice website, along with bio. And I've never turned down anybody for mm-hmm. a Zoom. And I've got more this week that have nothing to do with Rice or anything else.
Yeah.
They can, and that's the same for lots of really fine people that have all the information. But the great thing about what's going on now is that the information is everywhere. It's mm-hmm. in Boston. It's in New York. It's in Philly. It's yeah. in Cleveland. It's in. I mean, I'm just running the country from one end to the other.
Yeah.
And it's not all. It's in Seattle. It's in Oregon. It's in San Francisco. It's in Los Angeles. It's in San Diego. I mean, it's every all the information that you need of high quality is available if you take the trouble to figure out where to get it.
Yeah.
And I've done some people responding to people in unusual places. Having spent the time that Don Robertson and I spent in eastern New Mexico, when I get a phone call or an email from somebody in a weird location,
yeah,
I know what it's about and I know what they're going to ask.
Yeah,
but there will be a resource for that person, mm-hmm. which is spectacular.
Yeah, you kind of remind me of like Queen Victoria almost. They call her like the grandmother of Europe, right? Because she was able to procreate everywhere. So like, it's like if we had like a family tree, it's like, you know, Paul Ellison, Don, John, David, like all these people and Nina. And it, like you said, it's available everywhere. So I like that idea. You know, if you're studying, it doesn't mean you have to be right in New York City or right in Chicago. It's pretty available anywhere to study with a really wonderful person.
My very first student in Houston was 13-year-old Hal, because I was playing with his dad in the symphony. And,
yeah.
And his dad said, you got to take my son. I can't deal with the hormones anymore. And he needs a teacher that's not in the house. So we started that relationship at age 24 and 13. So yeah. it's fairly deep rooted.
Yeah.
And we love to talk about stuff from that period. When he was 13 and 14, he'd finish what he thought was the hour of his lesson. And he'd look at me and, is my lesson finished? My lesson's finished, isn't it? I said, well, it's an hour. An hour's gone by, but your lesson's not quite over yet.
Yeah, that's great. Paul, I feel like this is like talk number one of many, because we just scratched the surface of many facets of your life. Thank you so much for taking the time. This was extremely enjoyable and fascinating. I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. And go enjoy Rufus. Okay. Rufus and Gary right now, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep,
okay, so
sure.
Go enjoy. And thank you. I'll let you know when these are up. And I really appreciate it. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for being such a, I don't know whether to call you a host. You're a new friend and a wonderful musician. And it's just great to get to chat with you and hear what your mind comes up with.
Awesome. Well, wonderful. Thank you, Paul. And until next time.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.